And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lernis.
Hey everybody, it's Dean Haglund here in the post-production offices of Rational Exuberance, high above the tawny neighborhood of Los Feliz, next door to Hollywood, California. This is your Chilpack Hollywood Hour, and this is Dean with his co-host and yours, Mr. Phil Lernis, ladies and gentlemen.
You almost forgot how to do an opening.
I know. It's been so long.
It has been so long. Welcome to Los Feliz, everybody. We certainly hope you all enjoyed a Los Feliz Navidad.
See what you did?
I did.
Really jammed that in there.
It's the local advertising every year, don't you know?
Yes.
I have a little something in my throat, don't
you
I?
You do. A little frog. Called last night's Christmas party.
Oh, it wasn't last night, man.
No, it was three nights ago.
Well, you know, I was telling you, I was regaling you with the story.
Yes.
As we were walking up Vermont Avenue earlier. I've been on the East Coast.
Yes.
And it has been so much warmer there than in Los Angeles.
I heard it's unseasonably warm.
First of all, it's unseasonably cool here in Los Angeles.
I'm enjoying that cool.
Because ordinarily, as we know, it's usually 75, 80 and sunny on Christmas Day.
Right.
Here it's been in the 40s and the 30s and on the East Coast, 60s and 70s.
Right.
With rain. So things are blooming. There's complete seasonal confusion. And my hay fever kicked in. So without knowing, I became a bit of a mouth breather. Thanks to the pressure on my sinuses and the burning of my eyes. And that, coupled with really long day in the air coming back from the East Coast to L.A.
Oh, yeah. Recycled air of the old airplane.
Coupled with hitting these huge winds that we were having on Christmas Day.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Blowing everything into this mouth breather. And I had no voice yesterday.
And you just wrecked those golden vocal cords of yours.
So I have been gargling salt water and steaming.
Your face?
Like it's my job, because kind of it is.
and
we'll hope that...
it's done wonders for your complexion, though. Don't kid yourself.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's sleeping face down in a pan of gluten every day.
I didn't know you did that
still.
Yeah,
my skin is gluten fortified. but I can only hope my voice will last out this installment of your Chillpack Hollywood Hour. But I can guarantee you it won't sound any better next week. That's okay. Hint number one.
Hint number one. How do we do our shows? Post-production meeting on the air.
Hint number two is the fact that you will be posting things about being back in Australia, and yet you'll still be here in the neighborhood of Los Feliz.
Oh, my gosh. But it's great to be back. Let me tell you how much we missed Los Angeles. Coming back, we've seen all the sights, all the new things that have been constructed, all the other things that have been falling apart. And it's a joy to be back here in your post-production office that's fully cleaned for the holidays.
I was at a Christmas party, flew back into town, went to a Christmas party up at a historic house in the Hollywood Hills. And because of that wind, the air was so clear, right?
Yes.
So it's one of those nights where you realize the close proximity of everything in town.
Right.
Which you really don't appreciate when you're sitting in 45 minutes of traffic to get those few miles, right?
Right.
So downtown, clear as a bell, so right up upon us.
Right.
But the one magical element was at night, you can't see nor hear the 90 construction cranes. There are more construction cranes than there are high-rise buildings.
There's a building boom going on in downtown Los Angeles, the likes of which I've never seen. And they're building luxury high-rises. There's no other high-rises. There's not low. Well, no, there's some low-rises. If you say seven stories is low, then everything else is 40 to 60
stories. I thought you were going in a different direction with that. Not about the height, but about other than luxury. Like, there are no dumpy high-rises being built.
Dumpy high-rise. We're doing some low-cost high-rises.
No fixer-upper high-rises. Look, the elevator doesn't work all the way to the past 30.
Past 30. You got to walk from there on in.
It's a 40-flight walk-up from there.
If you don't mind. So, yes, it's exciting. I'm sure when I get back the next time, it'll be all done. I think it'll be finished and just pleasant to walk around in.
You really think it'll be?
No, I don't. See, I'm sure they're running out of parking lots to build stuff in. So, because for so long there was all the surface parking,
This is the question: how? I think won't downtown expand outward? Won't it go south of the 10? Won't they start knocking shit down out there?
And
building it up, but it'll move away.
Yeah, I think there'll always be a prejudice of if you're within the four freeways, that's downtown. Anything built beyond that.
But aren't they running out of room?
There's still some room to be had down in the industrial area and stuff.
I mean,
like
since we've gotten rid of all fashion construction jobs downtown. Might as well just knock down the old garment district.
There's still some happening. There's still manufacturing.
I listened to an episode of our show from many, many years ago. Mm-hmm. I have no idea how long ago now. Maybe 2008.
Wow.
Certainly we'd moved to Broadway from the old offices. But we were recording from the opening of Sip Tea.
I remember that place.
A place that no longer exists and hasn't for quite some time.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of our guests that night was Cynthia Vincent, fashion designer.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, she was talking about how, fashion employed more people in Los Angeles than film and television did.
Right.
But that is completely a thing of the past. We talk about runaway production in film and TV, but of course all construction and manufacturing's moved to China for fashion. So.
Well, yeah. And talk about my labels on my shirts. I was shopping, getting some deals, some Boxing Day deals yesterday. And everything's either manufactured now in Vietnam and Bangladesh. No longer just made in China is the label on your clothes. So I think that... That it's like any runaway production. You go after the cheapest dollar bid. Who's going to bid for your work? So it's global.
Also, which children have the most nimble little fingers?
You made us sad in Christmas.
Armaments and hand stitching are always done best with infant fingers.
Well, tell me then your East Coast Christmas stories.
What a great transition. We go from a story of a Broadway show past... in downtown Los Angeles, to regaling you with stories of shows from the Great White Way in New York City, something that we'll call the Chillpack Hollywood Hour live event of the week, won't we?
Let's hear that.
The Chillpack Hollywood live event of the week.
And because there's such exciting live events... Why not let it be distorted, the opening of that?
Blow the eardrums out of everyone with that. Fantastic.
As you know, one of my five all-time favorite books, because we did a show about our favorite reads of all time, is a book called Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime.
Yes.
It is told from the point of view of an autistic boy, high-functioning autistic boy. It's a challenging read because this boy finds at the opening... a beloved neighbor's dog, the dog is beloved by him, murdered.
Ah.
Not just dead, murdered. A pitchfork through it. So what they call in Britain, I think, a gardening fork.
Sure.
But we have to call it a pitchfork because otherwise we're already so confused about salad forks. And
I know.
So what do I use the big one for?
What's the gardening fork? Is that for killing the dog?
That must be for the leafy green salad.
Right. All right. The big one.
The other one's for the potato salad. Okay, I'm done with the fork stuff. Though kids, you know...
Wow, is this how the play went?
You know what Uncle Phil always says? Fork, then spoon. Okay, so...
These are the comedy bits that we rehearsed.
That I always, the old material that I use up at the end of the year before the new shipment arrives.
That's right. We're giving it away.
So it's a challenging book because this boy... decides he wants to solve the crime because no one else seems to be interested
right.
in who killed this dog. But the thing is, as a reader, you have to figure out what's really going on because you're sharing the point of view of someone who views the world through autism.
Right.
Math genius, but someone who, for example, doesn't understand metaphor.
Aha.
And when it's finally explained to him in a way he understands, it absolutely disturbs him to the point that he can't speak to anyone for a couple of days because the word metaphor itself is a metaphor, which makes him think the whole thing is a lie. They're just lies.
Just lies.
They're just ways of lying.
Fantastic.
So
you see this on stage.
So the book is completely unadaptable to the stage.
Right.
Unadaptable to stage or screen. So some people on a lark decide they'll try to adapt it to stage. They win, among other things, the Tony for Best Play. And rightfully so, because it's unbelievably awesome,
this
play.
You're kidding.
And I saw it with a new lead. The old lead won the Tony for Best Performance. This one can't be much out of Juilliard.
Yeah.
Still acne on the face.
Right.
Playing a bit younger, playing, I think, a 15-year-old or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And what a workout. This is a 2.5-hour ballet for this performer.
Is it that physical?
It's absolutely that physical because on stage, they have to, among other things, create a train trip all the way to London that he's taking on his own, and they have to recreate how the world looks and sounds to this person. So, of course, he's inundated with too much sensory stimulus.
Right.
But how do you do that without having a huge budget?
Yeah.
You do it with no set design, just lights and actors.
Wow.
Who often play the furniture, play the houses, play other things. So it is a fantastic, imaginative staging of one of the greatest stories I've ever read. And I'm not at a play. I'm not necessarily unfamiliar with this, but I'm also not easily weeping at a show 3 times.
What?
I wept at the show.
It wasn't your hay fever.
No. And I don't want to give away the first point.
Okay,
but nope. I do have to say that there is a member of the cast that has to be recast every 2 weeks because that member grows too old.
Good Lord. Every 2 weeks?
Every 2 weeks.
Holy crap.
Can you guess what that would be?
A baby?
A baby what, though?
Oh, baby doggy.
It's a puppy.
A puppy.
It has to be recast every 2 weeks.
Oh, my gosh.
So they never know what this puppy's going to do on stage.
Oh,
so
my God.
There's a little improvisation involved.
That's hilarious.
But the puppy this night loved this actor so much. And anyway, and then the curtain call for this young man when you get to see him drop character for the first time, it just made me weep. And then the Easter egg after many people had gone home.
You stay?
There's an Easter egg.
Yeah. No.
And
after the curtain call?
What's shocking is more people don't. I guess they thought it was a joke. A woman announces during it, stops the action to announce, look, we're not going to show you how this young man solved this math problem in 3 minutes that takes people 3 hours ordinarily to do if they're smart enough to do it.
Right.
Because it's the A-level maths that he's taking 3 years early. And we're not going to show you how he solved it in 3 minutes in what should have taken 3 hours if he got it right. But if you stay afterwards, we'll show you. So as many people have left, suddenly through a trap door in the stage, he comes up and the most elaborate lighting and design display emerges on screen and a clock counts down and he solves it for you in 3 minutes.
Yeah. That's fantastic.
So stay for the Easter egg, people.
That is awesome.
Great show. Then the other show, no plans to see this originally. It's a revival of Arthur Miller's A View from the Bridge.
Oh, yes. A classic, Arthur Miller.
Had played on Broadway not too long ago.
Uh-huh.
People I know were skeptical to see it.
Uh-huh.
But on the first night in New York, went to see our friend David Dean Bottrell perform in a live storytelling performance.
Right.
He crushed it. He won. It wasn't a competition. And he won. But all he could talk about was how we needed to see a view from the bridge. I mean, he was pushing this show so hard, I started to believe he owned stock in it.
Why was he put, like,
and
he'd
so
seen
we
it?
We asked other people.
Right.
Not that we don't trust him, but
you know, maybe he does own stock in it.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
So we asked other people and they all said, you know, we were really skeptical. And I go, yeah, see, we don't have to see
yeah.
this. And they said, single greatest Arthur Miller production ever. It had won all the Olivier Awards in England and had been transferred here. And Mark Strong, the wonderful actor Mark Strong, love him in Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, of course,
right.
villain in the first Sherlock Holmes movie.
Mm-hmm.
I know him from the old Prime Suspect series.
Right.
So much wonderful stuff, including his Jaguar commercials. he plays the lead in it. Anyway, so $20, this is my advice to all of you.
Okay.
Don't just see it. It runs through February 16th. See it as your friend in podcasting, Phil Airness.
Recommends.
$20 same day rush tickets on stage.
What?
You're on stage with unobstructed views for $20.
Come on.
Yeah.
And am I sitting behind looking?
Make sure you get the stage because the other rush tickets will be in the balcony and it's very obstructed.
Yeah.
Not great sight lines in this theater. But on stage, it's immersive and it's so good. Yeah. Not a pleasant. Look, this is not a comedy.
It's not.
This is Arthur Miller.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? I guess Death of a Salesman is his comedy compared to View from the Bridge.
Right.
That's so, his frothy, lighthearted
yes.
gambit.
That could be more entertaining than the death and demise of a poor salesman. So when you sat on stage, were you then part of the production, per se? Or were you just sort of the backdrop?
Well, I took a curtain call. But that, it turns out, was not looked upon fondly by the New York Police Department. Hey, I saw... it was Christmas.
Yeah.
Although I don't know if, you know, so many laws have changed. Are we allowed to say Christmas on podcasts?
I'm saying
anymore?
It. Yes.
Because you can't say it apparently in any schools or anything like that. Went to see, Lily's godson in what I thought was going to be a Christmas concert.
Right.
But it was almost entirely secular music.
Just music of Nikola Tesla.
Even like the Handel piece that they did was a secular piece. The Christmas carols that they did were secular.
Right. Rudolph.
But most of it, you know, it's like, here's the fourth grade orchestra playing the Star Wars theme.
They did not.
Yeah, they did do it. And the teacher introduced it. He said, because we like to have our music relate to current events. Is Star Wars current event?
Well, listen.
Or is it a pop culture event?
But it's currently an event worldwide.
Nothing that is about hoary nostalgia being shoved down your throat is a current event.
What is that? What Christmas is? Or is that? No.
Oh, that's an interesting thing.
See, there's two great disappointments for me this holiday season. One is having to miss the opening in Melbourne.
You were supposed to go to that.
I know, but a tornado came and stopped all flights, and I missed my flight. My flight was canceled. I had to go home. And then my second disappointment was getting here and actually seeing Star Wars.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh,
okay. We'll talk about this in a while. But the point is
yes.
that, yes, interesting what you say about isn't that what Christmas is?
It's hoary nostalgia.
I mean, we're jumping ahead a little bit, but why not?
Why not?
Because I do want to talk about a couple of Christmassy things while we're still in live events that had always been kind of on my to-do list,
right.
believe it or not. But should I do those and then we talk about?
I don't know. Let's see if we can.
The hoary nostalgia.
The hoary nostalgia. What event?
Yes, look, two things were on my to-do list and then I'll talk about. One was I had never seen a traditional Christmas play in a church, you know, like people enacting the main
things and knocking on the door of the inn, no room on the inn.
Parodied so effectively in that show that Lily did at the Geffen, Coney Island Christmas, where adult performers in their early 20s play the kids in a Christmas pageant, right?
Yeah, it's classic.
I mean, I I vaguely am aware that I did something like that when I was in elementary school, but again, it's short. Even back then, it was short on the religious context, right?
Right, right.
Now you can't do it at all. Now it's only in church.
In churches,
so I went and I attended St. Columba's church to watch this, and they've been doing this play many years. It's a fan favorite. Don't kid yourself.
Everybody loves that one.
I walked out.
Oh no!
During it. Yeah,
because so, you knew how to end it.
I just, you know, I didn't find it very believable.
What, shepherds watching their sheep by night in winter?
I guess I don't like science fiction on stage. No, that's not true. No, you know why it wasn't believable was nobody cared. Look, I understand it's not a professional piece.
Right.
But.
There you go. Oh.
Oh, Fuzz is trying to get on the show. No one
cared.
It's not that they didn't care, but there was no authenticity. There was no, you know, it's like everybody, even the adults are like, isn't it cute that we're pulling the phony donkey? Everyone's winking about this stuff. And it's like, wait a minute, aren't all of you supposed to take this story sacred?
Right.
And if you're supposed to take it to be sacred, well, then doesn't it require a sacrifice on your part, because that's what makes it sacred. And that might be your ego or your sense of
mockery
or, you know, which is usually drawn out of self-consciousness.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why don't you be earnest about this?
Right.
An earnest performance by amateurs, no matter what the material, can be really moving.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I walked out because I didn't get what I kind of wanted, which was some kind of
sacred ritual.
I don't exactly, at least that. So the other thing that I did that was on my to-do list, lifelong to-do list, was to attend Christmas Mass, late night Christmas Mass at the National Cathedral.
Oh, in D.C.?
They would put on a good show.
One would think.
And boy, is it a big production.
Is that right?
And I took a photo that I'll show later, and maybe I'll post at some point, just on my camera phone. And for it to have turned out this good
epic
on the phone there is incredible. But it's the Gothic Cathedral atop the hill that is the National Cathedral, with the full moon peering through the storm clouds. No, peering through the storm clouds.
Oh.
And both are visible. And it's just such a great way to enter into it. Now, I wish that there had been a blanket of snow like in most years there would be,
instead
of people in shorts and roller skates going in. And by the way, one word about Broadway. I understand people don't get dressed up like they used to. And I became aware of this many years ago when, as you know, I saw August Osage County, and Gary Sinise was sitting across the aisle from me. And yes, he produced August Osage County on stage, but T-shirt and jeans. And I thought, you know, this is just so disrespectful. These people are giving their all to this thing. You know, to me, it's like going to church.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that's a bad example now, since nobody gets dressed up for church.
Is that right?
But on Broadway, there were maybe, like a curious incident, I counted maybe 10 people in suits, most of them not wearing ties.
Right.
80% of the men in the audience in T-shirts.
And
not their going out T-shirts either.
They're staying in T-shirts.
Anyway, So I went into this, and I have nothing really to say about this except that it was an impressive performance. Hearing a choir,
you know,
sing this music in
midnight mass
with such acoustics.
How
can you not be moved?
Yes, exactly.
And at the same time, you know, wishing that more life is breathed into some of these rituals. You know. Yeah. The understanding of what they mean, maybe the explanation of what they mean, so that every step someone takes is embodied with a contemporary urgency.
Right.
Even, you know, you're able to do that during a sermon.
Yes.
But it seems like, you know, maybe there's a way to not reinvent the wheel.
No.
But breathe new life back into it, because I must say that at least for this observer, it was seeming somewhat stayed. And again, I'm not seeing it year after year either.
Right, right.
So
you think that the annual ritual becomes by rote as opposed to
a little
to
bit.
By,
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
By urgent emotional need
to do this sacred thing.
And another thing that they could have learned, something they could have learned from Quentin Tarantino, of all people. Maybe put an intermission in that thing.
Let's take a gap, go to the bathroom, have a chat.
Great seats, though. Reserved seats passing by all of the... of the Washington D.C. bourgeoisie going up to my reserved seats.
Look
there.
At you!
You know, when you're America's, and dare I say, the world's friend in podcasting, there are perks.
There are little perks.
There are perks.
Few and far between.
Look at this. We're almost halfway through a show.
Oh my God!
We have so much to talk about. But so this the joke that I made about hoary nostalgia shoved down your throat, and you said, "Isn't that what Christmas is?" It made me remember a conversation I had with one of our listeners, Jimmy Lawler.
Oh, yes.
Who actually said it was so odd to be talking to me in person where my voice was normal speed because he has, I think, a half hour commute. So he listens to our shows in double time so he can fit a whole show in. He really does this. And he got that idea from someone who wrote in to our show and we read it on the show.
All right.
Who did the same thing.
Right.
But he... as with many people I had talked to, or a handful of people, he stopped watching A Very Murray Christmas on Netflix.
Yes.
About a third of the way through.
About a third. One third.
Of an hour.
Right where the blackout happens, I would say.
Yeah, maybe right after Chris Rock.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's so interesting how people aren't getting what they want from it. So they turn it off. And we live in this age where if you don't get what you want immediately, we turn it off, which explains why... Star Wars, which gives you what you want, is going to be the biggest hit of all time.
Yeah.
Never mind if it gives you what you need or gives you what you deserve.
Yeah.
But it's what you want. So it's this kind of comfort food that we can just do. And we live in this horrible era. There's many great things about having all of human expression at our fingertips.
And in a moment's notice, yes.
But the downside to it is if everything's available, everything becomes disposable.
Right.
So if it doesn't please you immediately, you're shutting it off.
Yeah.
And art is meant to, all of storytelling, all of it in some way, no matter what it is, from Sesame Street, which did a great job of this, to Star Wars, to A Very Merry Christmas, is meant to expand us in some way. Right?
Yes.
Not to comfort us staying exactly where we are.
Or shrinking.
Which was always the fear of some people. Alec Guinness, chief among them, who participated in the original Star Wars and realized, he even wrote before he died in his memoirs, can you imagine 30 years from now, if there's still a culture that's watching Star Wars, how pathetic and horrible and destructive that will be for our culture? Because it means we'll be arrested in secondhand, because all of Star Wars was based on old myths,
right.
We'll be arrested in secondhand childhood banalities.
Wow.
And
he nailed it.
So A Very Merry Christmas, people are turning it off because it's not pleasing them.
Right.
And it's not giving them what they want. Now it's giving me what I want, which is grumpy Bill Murray.
Right.
but then what's interesting is it moves into an entirely different Christmas special once there's this blackout, because it's behind the scenes of a Christmas special he's doing.
Right.
What's going off the rails from the beginning and rapidly becoming the worst Christmas special ever, right?
Right, right.
Before it even starts.
Yeah.
And then there's a blackout. They can't go on. So then he moves to the bar with Paul Schaefer playing himself, of course.
Yeah.
And they just start to drink the Christmas away.
Right.
And they start to make friends with people there.
Right.
And they do kind of an impromptu Christmas party.
Yeah.
Which becomes the second part. And I actually quite enjoy that part.
I thought that was fun.
And then something happens. And the third act gives the kind of Christmas special that I think a lot of people wanted from the outset. So Bill Murray gives you what you want, knowing what you want, but it's hard-earned.
Yeah, you have
to. He has to find a way to revive it, to breathe life into it, so that it's earned.
Yeah.
So that nostalgia isn't just all exercise
in
giving people secondhand childhood banalities, but instead breathing life into it as this kind of fantasy that is a fulfillment of what we want.
And put it in a context of some sort. This is exactly, the third act is the context, because the first two acts set up that final thing. And so, as it is with Star Wars childhood banality, what's even weirder, have you seen it? I haven't even asked. Did you go see this Force Awakens thing?
I did see. I saw something else, though, from Lucasfilm related.
Oh?
Beforehand.
Tell me.
That I thought would be the segue, but it all kind of ties in, I think, in an interesting way. and that is, I went to the National Geographic Museum.
Oh, I love that place.
Where there is an interactive Indiana Jones exhibit.
Ah, neato.
And they use the movies, all the movies, as a jumping off point for
anthropology and geography and all that.
The tools of archaeology through the years.
Oh, right.
From the golden age of archaeology of the 20s and 30s, where we first get to know Indiana Jones, through the 50s and the 60s, where it begins to change.
Right.
And the purpose of it changed, the thrust of it, the tools change. And so it uses this as a jumping off point for, you know, what do we see in these movies that are really how archaeologists go about their, what was inspired by real life.
Right.
And then there's the fact versus fiction of the MacGuffins, of what he's going after.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Of the Ark of the Covenant.
The Crystal Skulls.
Okay. So they do the Crystal Skulls, right? And the, and I was worried, I was wondering, like, would they do this? Will there be a Shia LaBeouf presentation? Will there, what is it, you know? And indeed they do. They give equal weight to all the movies.
Yeah.
They get to the Crystal Skulls, and what's fantastic is they use it as the jumping off point for a study of the Nazca tribe.
Right.
And the Nazca lines.
And all those and large things.
Fantastically fascinating. Their whole civilization, fantastically fascinating. In a way, maybe that the Kingdom of the Crystal Skulls was not. a movie that I enjoyed. I couldn't understand all the people who, you know, just berated that movie. And I was thinking, didn't you see the third one? but anyway, you know, and it's that the famous joke, Spielberg did the third one to apologize for the second one, which only makes me think he did the fourth to apologize for the third. And no wonder there's talk of a fifth now. But the Crystal Skulls.
Yes.
And in looking at this exhibit, I finally got the complaint that many people had. Because people would say to me that their real problem with Kingdom of the Crystal Skulls was this science fiction device of the skulls versus a historic device like the
Raiders
the
of Grail, the Grail.
Like the Grail.
The Holy Grail.
Never mind that the Shankara stones in Temple of Doom are made up at wholesale.
Right.
There are no Shankara stones. Shankara was a philosopher. There is this belief that godly energy can be embodied in relics.
Right.
But those relics are completely made up by the writers.
Right.
But, you know, but no, it's the Kingdom of the Crystal Skulls that really got people's goat, even though there are crystal skulls.
Yeah.
It's the only actual artifact that we know in all those movies physically exists.
Yes.
Because we found them. Yeah. But I finally got it, I think. People didn't express it this way, but maybe this, I'll run this up your flagpole.
Okay.
And see if it sticks.
Okay.
It's the fact that these have proven, first of all, they're fairly recent.
Yes.
1800s, as opposed to, you know, these mysteries 2,000 years or older.
Right.
So there's that.
Right. We only found these skulls in the 1800s.
And we relatively quickly were able to ascertain that they were made in the 1800s by human hands.
Right.
So they were debunked immediately.
Right.
Right. And whereas the myth around all of these other things is something that you can't debunk. That's not the point of it.
Right.
Right. It's truly, they're truly mysteries.
Right.
And mysteries' purpose is to reveal us through their exploration.
Right. I get that. Bless you.
So there isn't this sense of being able to really enjoy the what is it, what does it do, what's the mythology around it, when you already know it's fake.
Oh, I see. Hence why it's science fiction at that point, because it's already a fake artifact that has no... But are the Crystal Skulls fake? Because I thought there was one of... I mean, you know, there were replicas done in the 1800s. After finding one that they had neither, or are they all fake?
Look, I mean, at the point of offending all our conspiracy friends, let's just say now, of course, the National Geographic is, they're the man, right? Never mind that they're a lone voice in the wilderness arguing in favor of maybe doing something about climate change.
Right.
So that, if nothing else, I don't get hay fever attacks in a spring that has started in December on the East Coast. But enough about me.
Enough about you complaining,
so,
Grandpa.
You know, yeah, National Geographic, you know,
okay,
are the man. So, but no, they would strongly come down on the side of, yeah, they're
okay, fake. Fake.
And, but they also, you know, said something else, which I thought was really poignant and also a problem of the movie, which is to even care about these crystal skulls is to ignore all the deeper, richer mysteries of the Nazca civilization.
That's so true.
And so that's, and isn't that often the thing that disappoints me about so much alternative thought or conspiracy theories or this is, you know, you are overlooking a greater mystery.
Right.
Through trying so hard to prove
this one element
thing in it. And, you know, it's about asking better questions, but questions that enliven and embolden and enlarge us.
Right.
So, and I thought this exhibit did that very well, but certainly that final or the most recent Indiana Jones movie did not.
Did not.
In any way. Again, it was a little bit more trying to give us what it thought we wanted.
Right.
And, but doing so in a fairly rote fashion, doing it in a way that used the ease and convenience of modern technology.
Yeah.
And why not? Because if you're Steven Spielberg, why do you really want to do another one of these? You've moved so far beyond it.
One would hope you've moved so far beyond it.
And so, yet. So him just giving us what we want had a little bit of a tossed off feel to it, like a great rock and roll star still playing the hits.
Yeah.
You know, wanting to do his new material, but he knows, well, I've got to do the hits, so here they are.
Here they are.
And there's a little bit of a lackluster feel to it.
Totally.
So that's why you go and you get someone like J.J. Abrams.
Who
is specializes in trying to recreate the thrills that other filmmakers gave him.
Right. A rock and roll stars. So he's a great karaokeist.
So you have him and you go into Star Wars Force Awakens and you already know a couple of things, without having seen it.
Yeah.
You know, if you accept that, okay, these myths upon which Star Wars were based were reimaginings of the ancient myths.
Right.
As explained by Joseph Campbell. George Lucas was a big student of Joseph Campbell.
Right.
So these are secondhand myths.
Yes.
And now, with J.J. Abrams and his approach to storytelling, be it the Mission Impossible movies, be it the Star Trek movies, be it now this, he, or what was that thing that he did, 8mm.
Oh, 8mm.
My goodness.
Yeah, yeah.
Which you could have believed, if it had come from a time capsule, was a Steven Spielberg movie made 30 years ago.
Yeah, totally.
And then you find, but then you know it's not, and you go, well,
what?
So this is a photocopy.
Right.
A little blurry.
Of a 70s rock band.
Right. Yep. So now you have a photocopy of a secondhand story,
right,
is what you know you're going to get going into Star Wars Force Awakens.
You know that.
But
you wouldn't know it, like, not just a photo, it's a pastiche. It's not even like I put it on the glass plate face down and hit record. I had taken it, torn it to pieces, and reassembled it poorly.
Which is like Star Wars, which is, I mean, Star Trek,
right,
is a pastiche of that universe, finding out a clever way to reinvent it in that first one.
Right, a clever way.
And again, Star Trek by J.J. Abrams is a superior action-adventure film.
Yes.
It's not particularly got a lot of Star Trek in it.
True.
Star Trek Force Awakens, or whatever the second one was, Into Tomorrow,
yeah,
Star Trek Into Darkness.
Star Trek Into Darkness.
Is a dreadful picture.
Yes.
And something that seeks out new, bold ways to take a steaming dump all over the mythology of Star Trek.
Right.
All right. So it succeeds at the latter. It fails at the former of being an action film. So, you know, I said, you remember when he left the director's chair
for Star Trek?
To go to Star Wars, I said he may just be saving two franchises with one move.
Right, exactly.
Now, I did not know who was going to be directing the third Star Trek and writing the third Star Trek film at that point.
Right.
Simon Pegg writing it. Justin Lin from the Fast and the Furious movies directing it. A friend of mine from my old UCLA days.
Right.
Saw that Star Trek Beyond trailer.
Yeah.
I like the website that called it Star Trek Beyond Redemption. And all I can say to you Fast and the Furious fans is you'll really enjoy this movie, apparently. This looks so insulting, the new Star Trek film.
Is that right?
Yes,
Star Trek Tokyo Drift?
Yes, they explore a new civilization, apparently. But you remember that moment in the first Star Trek movie where Kirk is listening, young Kirk is listening to the Beastie Boys, Sabotage, and he
driving the Corvette
and hangs off a cliff.
Yeah, yeah.
The whole trailer is the Star Trek characters, fully grown, listening to Beastie Boys Sabotage, hanging off of things or hurtling through the air in extreme sports. Yeah,
no.
Dirt bike sequences.
What?
In this movie. Okay. So anyway, Fast and the Furious 8 coming to theaters than we thought.
Right.
Yes.
Fantastic.
So J.J. Abrams does go to Star Wars, where he actually has an affection for the material, right?
Seems to.
Well, he was always an avid Star Wars fan.
Yeah, for sure.
So I sit down, and I hope the movie will give me a good time. I hope I'm going to be surprised, and there's going to be some connection to the ancient myths upon which this story is based.
Perhaps.
There only is that, again, through its reinvention. You say pastiche. Honestly, I spent a lot of the time saying this is just a remake of the first Star Wars.
Yeah.
And
but it's remade in a weird assembly.
But with no personal connection to these myths that inspired it in the first place. The connection to the inspiration is completely now secondhand.
Yeah.
So there's no one actually breathing life into it.
Nobody's
which
inspired.
Is the process, exactly, of giving birth to something.
Right.
The beginning of the movie's clunky. It's just, it is just, it is not a well-executed first act, I think, even.
Yeah.
Introduction of characters is poor.
The meet-cutes are not, they're ham-fisted.
The camera work is ham-fisted,
even.
And it's kind of appallingly incompetent, really, from a technical standpoint, given J.J. Abrams' usual technical competency.
Yes.
I don't think he has any expertise. I think he has great, great competency. And it's lacking in the first third.
Okay.
But what I was stunned by, and give credit where credit is due... A pretty good second act, a pretty darn entertaining second act of this. I was kind of surprised where I went just at the point where I thought this movie was off the rails. It recovers itself. I don't know exactly when that is.
Right.
But certainly by the time Han Solo appears, the movie's working.
Sort of, yes.
And as a standalone story, this thing is working. It's entertaining.
Right.
It's fun.
What?
It does return to Star Wars what had been missing through that whole prequel trilogy,
right?
Which namely was any fun,
right,
whatsoever.
Yes.
And so that's back.
Hooray.
Of course, there was the connection to the mythology still in that original prequel.
Yeah.
And that's all gone, like I said. But that's all right. Those movies were just drudge work to get through.
Yeah.
This, at least, is fun. Some of these young performers, John Boyega as Finn and Daisy Ridley as Rey, seem really good.
Really good.
Really up for the task.
Yes.
Great diversity.
Like it.
They're bringing their all to this. It was comforting to see Harrison Ford back as Han Solo, but also discomforting in the sense that I was going, okay, how much of the fact that the movie's fun for the first time since maybe the first half of Return of the Jedi is because of Harrison Ford?
Right.
Handsome. You know, he kind of disappears in the second half of Return of the Jedi, surrounded by all the Ewoks,
yeah.
And the movie stops being really much fun at that point. So how much of the sense of fun is owed to that actor in that role?
As a fun guy. And a fun character.
Yeah. And I'd be really worried about that, fans, since he won't be back.
Right. Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So, but thank God he made his $25 million. Did you see that?
No!
$25 million. Carrie Fisher and Hamill both got low seven figures.
Oh, no.
Mark Hamill got in the millions for that performance with the understanding that their salaries will increase as their roles increase.
Increase on the next.
But this was Harrison Ford's, and he deserved every penny of it, I believe, for restarting this franchise.
Absolutely.
Because without him, I don't think this movie works at all. and without him, I have a hard time believing this is gonna, there's gonna be a lot of weight on Mark Hamill's shoulders.
Absolutely. To carry this thing, oh my God.
And how about J.J. Abrams, who loves Star Wars, leaving the franchise after this one? I think he's getting out while the getting is good.
Yeah, exactly. Because it could only go down, technically.
And I don't think Lawrence Kasdan might be writing the next one as well. So that was another bit that was enjoyable, was that the tone and the voice
was
of
back.
The writing
yeah.
was back.
Yeah. The tone was there. It was just, but it was just the same. For me, the pastiche was like so obviously torn from the pages of the first script and just sort of placed in there, similar to the way George Lucas took World War II footage of planes of breaking formation before they had the digital effects of the X-Wing coming into the Death Star in the first movie. This one seemed to take actual script pages from the first movie, put it into where they were going to rewrite that scene as a bridge for the first draft, it seemed, and then nobody went and did it. So it felt like it was, you know, oh, we got that Katina band. Why don't we just have like some sort of multi-ethnic, multi-species bar? Yeah, that'll be good. And in the basement, instead of, and basement, we'll put the lightsaber. That's how you find the lightsaber.
Yeah, there was times when I felt like we were walking onto Harry Potter sets.
I know. It's just like, oh, dear Lord, is this how we
and
do these movies
almost
now?
Like there's no faith in the new characters. And honestly, like you mentioned the bar sequence, I would have had faith in that character.
Yeah.
If I were them. And Lupita Nyong'o, who I think it was probably a motion capture performance.
Yeah.
And who voices it, is terrific.
Yeah.
As the proprietor that. And I would have had faith in these characters.
Yeah.
I would have let the Force be with them.
It's like anything. Yeah.
So I feel like you were
more
looking
offended.
Forward to it, and so therefore you're offended by it.
It was such a letdown. I think because my hopes are so, and particularly after missing it in Melbourne and everybody going, and I'm texting everybody going, "How was? Oh, it's brilliant! It's fantastic! I receive all this stuff." Going,
and this is where I'm knocking my head against the wall, wondering why I even bother. Look, I don't expect audiences to do anything other than eat this up, you know, with shovels.
Yeah.
Like they did Jurassic World.
For some reason.
Even though all of them pretty much acknowledge, everyone I talk to who saw it more than one, yeah, it's terrible.
It's terrible.
But it's so much fun. All right.
All right.
It's great.
Maybe.
You're going to keep getting the movies that you want, I guess.
By paying
and
for
God
whichever.
Forbid, you're going to get what, you know, anything better, anything that I think we deserve.
Right.
But something like, I don't know, the first Star Wars.
Yes.
So, after I saw it, someone quickly wrote me and said, you know, were you disappointed? And I said, disappointed? No. I grew up, and that was more or less my feeling about it.
Right. It's back to Alex.
I mean, I stopped playing with Star Wars toys a long time ago, and
now you're just grumpy old man.
And I guess, but there are so many more fascinating, beautiful, deep, meaningful mysteries explored through myths and storytelling. Star Wars might have been my in to those,
right?
But
I don't think I have to stay there and be stagnant.
I don't have to stay there. I don't have to, you know, stand by the person who introduced me to them. And so there's that. I'm also, did you notice the demographic breakdown on the box office?
No.
71% of everyone seeing this, men over 25 years of age.
Oh, really?
So it's
the guy thing to do.
It's middle-aged dudes are making this a huge, huge thing. Anything that's 71% men...
says there's a problem.
Even like, I don't know, I would think even, you know, like gay men night at a nightclub
might not be
so much fun, you know? Whenever you have all one demographic, how much fun can it be?
It's so
anyway,
true.
So, but I'm really, it'll be interesting to see what comes next, I guess. But what comes next, of course, will be even more box office.
Wow.
I'm sure. But my question that I wanted to puzzle over.
Oh, let's puzzle this question at the end of our show.
Is why such great reviews? Just like why such great reviews for the second Star Trek movie? Mm. Now, I always said for Star Trek Into Darkness, a lot of these critics may not appreciate Star Trek. When Star Trek was good, a lot of these critics may not have been around.
Right.
Star Trek may literally have been something that was their dad's thing.
Right.
So they don't care.
Right.
And then maybe a lot of critics who actively didn't like Star Trek enjoyed this pastiche that was kind of making fun of what we loved about Star Trek. But critics loved that movie in a way that audiences, especially here, did not. It did not do well, the second Star Trek movie.
Right.
Not related to its budget, not related to the first one, not related to return on investment. Okay. So, but critics loved it.
Right.
The reviews are like 94% positive.
Just what I, except for that.
And the only one that really I went and go, well, that's exactly how I felt, was I think it was either the New Yorker or the Atlantic,
yeah,
who said, we're not going to give any plot spoilers in this review. Not out of any sense that that's part of a critic's job. Because more or less, analyzing both text and subtext and context is a critic's job.
Absolutely.
Who gives a shit about spoilers? We live in this era of don't spoil anything for me, which is a sign of how bad storytelling is. Because a sign of a good story is when you know what's happening and you're already engaged in it.
Yeah.
When you see a film a second time and it's still as engaging and
moving. And it resonates still deeply within you.
Maybe even deeper.
Yeah.
Right?
That you know the story and
once
you see it again.
Once surprise is over, then you get to explore the layers of it.
Yes.
Okay. So this reviewer, and again, it was either New Yorker or Atlantic, but one of the biggies said, so it's not out of a sense of that we're not going to give away any plot spoilers.
Right.
It's the fact that, like any J.J. Abrams work, plot twists are all that this has going for it.
That's true.
And they weren't doing it as a mean joke.
Right.
And then there was an analysis of his visual approach, which is his visual approach does not tell story. You do not discover character out of his, there's no psychological element, which is why I say that he doesn't have an expertise, he has a competence. There's no psychological element to the visual construct of his quote-unquote art.
Right.
All there is a competent staging of the written story.
Yes.
Which is not a director's job.
No, that's the first AD's job.
This is the you know, the script is the blueprint.
Yeah.
The filming is the building,
right,
that you're making.
Right, the piece of art.
And but not in this.
So
why, though, all
why the positive reviews? Well, then the one guy who has negative reviews gets death threats, gets all this feedback. And I think this feedback loop now from critic to audience and then audience back to critic has diminished everybody from being a critic, that you just don't sit alone with your thoughts after seeing a film and go, here's my critical analysis of this piece of work, and then you type it up and some people read it. Now it's, hey, you're an idiot if you hated the thing I liked, and go to hell, and I'll see you when I murder your head, and, you know, like all that stuff.
You mean the emails we're going to get?
Yes.
In the next...
You know what? But it's we, A, have not spoiled anything, and B, we have... You have given more praise than I thought deserved of that thing in the first place.
So, and he... So in other words, I've been like most critics. Because here's the thing. Would I end up giving it a quote-unquote positive review?
Yeah.
If it was a thumbs-up, thumbs-down system?
Right.
I would say thumbs-up. I would do the old Roger Ebert, Gene Siskel, thumbs-up with a caveat. Which is, this movie's really bad for us.
Right.
Culturally.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Is the movie itself fun and entertaining, and are you going to get your money's worth? Yeah, you probably will.
Right.
As a human being drawing Earth on the air on the planet Earth in the early 21st century, you're probably going to enjoy it. 100 years from now, they're going to be laughing at us. If there is anyone 100 years from now still alive, because an entire species that got trapped in secondhand childish banalities was able to hand anything over to future generations in the first place. You like what I did there?
I do.
So that's a little bit negative. But I love what you said about critics go, what's the point in making everyone hate us? So you appreciate that, look, it is fun. It is competent storytelling.
Right.
This is gee whiz bang action and adventure. Why not give it a good review? Especially because we want our readers to stay with us, because we're going to champion what we think, especially at this time of year, are either the best films or the most overlooked films.
Right.
Where we still have the possibility to make an impact.
Right.
Which is to help films that we think didn't find an audience, to make sure that they survive so that they can find an audience.
Right.
If enough critics build a consensus around those movies, they still have an impact, and a big impact. They
right.
can save movies. They can't damage a movie like Star Wars at all. So I think you're right. I think that's it.
They go,
it would be dumb of them to do what you're doing.
Yeah, exactly.
And what I kind of just did. But again, as a film critic, thumbs up. As
right.
a social critic, SMH, people.
Right.
Shaking my head.
Shaking my head.
Boy, you know, we didn't get into so much what I wanted to talk about, but I think it was a great show. And I would like to end by throwing something out to you then as kind of this counter to Star Wars, because there was a science fiction adventure mythological franchise from roughly the same era that returned to us this year.
What was that?
And to not at all the same level of box office success or anticipation of Star Wars, and yet it's a movie that may very well get a Best Picture nomination, and based on the Metacritic consensus, which we're a month from probably locking down, but is already without a doubt the number one consensus top film of the year, according to critics. It just won the most nominations from the Critics' Choice Awards and from the London Film Critics Circle. It won. It's Mad Max Fury Road.
Ah, wow.
And what do we make of the yin and yang of these hallowed late 70s, early 80s franchises returning to us now and
resonate and echoing back?
And maybe this gives me hope, because both are at least competent storytelling.
Right.
Better than what we might have expected a few years back. Better than what we got with Jurassic World.
Yes.
Right. But also films that owe their ancestry to some rich, again, mythological themes being explored. But one is a huge box office gift of giving you exactly what you want.
Right.
It's the candies we give you at Christmas year after year after year.
Yes.
And the other is a work of art.
Ah.
You know, Lily Holloman, no big fan of the violent movies.
Blowing up stuff.
But I asked her, I didn't have the courage during the movie, I asked her walking out of this intense, visceral experience of Mad Max Fury Road in 3D, no less.
Oh, my God.
What did you think? And she said, I saw a work of art.
Wow.
And so it's a film that I think belies its gift wrapping. The gift that will only reveal
more
its emotional significance to you more and more with each passing year. But how fascinating that they both come in the same year.
Isn't that fascinating?
And by the way, we're wrapping up a year right now.
Right now.
This is the end of our final installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour for 2015.
15. It's the future as we know it. And that's how it ends.
What? The future is over?
Yeah, it's the present now. So,
you know, you can find every installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour at chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood.com.
Find us at Facebook, facebook.com/chillpackhollywood.
You can follow us on Twitter.
Please do. We're Dean and Phil.
Absolutely. Spell out the and. Write us chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. We had some emails, great emails we didn't get to. We'll get to them in the future. We like talking about what you want us to talk about.
Right.
It's what we mean when we say it's your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. Thanks to Blog Talk Radio for hosting us for another year.
Hooray!
Thanks for the good folks at Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas.
Mm-hmm.
They sponsor your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. Thanks for another great year, Dean Haglund. Happy
Thank
New
you.
Year.
Happy New Year to you, sir. Till next year.
I'm Phil Larinus.
I'm Dean Haglund.
Belated spoiler alert.